is that? This is Holly Palmer. This afternoon, I'm talking with my friend, Paul Rebillard. Paul happens to be one of the few people I know who was born in Taconic, Connecticut. Paul, would you tell us why a person with a French name like yours comes from Taconic?
Sure, Holly. It just happens to be that I've written a few words on the subject, and if you don't mind, I'll tell you about it. And at any time if you'd like to interrupt me, just go right ahead or ask questions as you wish.
Great.
Well, I thought to begin with, I should start at the beginning. And the actual beginning is, of course, my father. So I'll proceed with my thoughts, and I hope it comes up with something that you might like.
Would you give us your father's name?
My father's name was Ernest Rebillard, no middle name.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll get into this thing by saying it's sobering indeed to have people look at you and point a finger at you and recognize you for what you are. But it is true, I'm one of a diminishing band of people who have had contact with those who were a part of the past. It is difficult to realize that we were mature, or those who were mature a century ago, had memories that went back to the days of Abraham Lincoln.
Right.
Isn't that something?
Mm-hmm.
My father knew people who were alive in 1812, and many of them who served in the Civil War.
Imagine.
Yeah. He was born near Belfast in 1858, and remembered the War of 1870, when France was crushed the first time by Germany. His parents, my grandparents, were bakers in the tiny village of Chenevier, and their home was taken over by German soldiers, and they were induced to bake the dark bread the Germans liked so well. My father, at age 12, was forced to help bury both French and German dead.
Oh, my.
At age 14, my father came to this country for 7 years, then returned to his country to serve 2 years in the French army, as everyone must, of course.
Did he come to Salisbury when he was 14?
No, actually, he went to in the area of Buffalo, where he had friends.
Uh-huh.
And during that time, he, I don't know what he worked at, but I would think something connected with the iron industry in Buffalo.
Yes.
But I'm not too sure of that, except at that time, I know that he became quite adept at tumbling. He was quite something of an athlete at that time. He was very, very agile. He told me a lot of things about pertaining to that. But at any rate, he did return and serve 2 years in the French Army. Then he returned to America in 1881 and settled in Salisbury, or close to it at least.
Mm-hmm.
Strangely, he joined several other families whose names are still well known in the area. The Gobelos, the Uvars, the Goos,
yes.
The Bonnetels, the Bouteliers, DeVos, all came from that tiny little village in France.
Yes.
All attracted by one phase or another of the iron industry that was booming here at that time. All of the above-named people actually were nearer to the Sharon area.
Yes.
That was close to the iron business, too. My father always said he landed on Mount Washington, but from what mode of travel, I never did find out. But at any rate, he was one of several Frenchmen who made charcoal, mountains of charcoal, for the forges of Mount Raga, Lime Rock, and I'm sure many other glass furnaces in the area. They chopped and piled wood for the charcoal pits, as they were called, until the mountain ranges that we can see from Salisbury were almost completely denuded of woodland. In fact, some areas were cleared and used as farmland, well up on the eastern slopes.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of fact, when I was a boy, we went up on those mountain slopes to pick berries in some of those open places. Pick blackberries.
Blueberries?
Blackberries. Blackberries mainly. Mm-hmm. Blueberries grew on the top of the mountain then, as they still
do.
The mountain top was well populated at that time by those who worked at charcoal and iron. To this day, if you wander through that area, you will find innumerable cellar holes, many still producing lilac bushes that seem to be present at every house.
Uh-huh.
Is that not so?
Uh-huh.
You still find lilac bushes almost everywhere around old houses or old cellar holes. But at any rate, the charcoal pits were constructed by the artful piling of 4-foot wood to a height of about 12 feet and a diameter of 20 to 25 feet.
Mm-hmm.
You've seen pictures.
Not
of
very
them,
big,
sure.
Yeah.
Well, they're pretty big. Mm-hmm. You figure 12 feet high and a diameter of 20 to 25 feet is quite a large mound.
Mm-hmm.
The mound of wood was then covered with soil and sod to contain the fire underneath.
Sure.
So the combustion was slow and incomplete. A lot of people don't understand how charcoal was made, but that's how it was made. And woe to the unlucky workman who was careless enough to allow the coal to erupt uncontrollably and thus burn to ashes the work of many hours of back-breaking work. The successfully completed pit produced hundreds of bushels of beautiful black charcoal, so beautifully wrought that the grain of the original wood was still clearly identifiable.
Is that right?
So that the species of wood used could easily be recognized. You've probably seen it. The grain still shows in the charcoal. This charcoal was carted in huge wagons with high sloping sides, the product being so light that it permitted great loads to be transported long distances to their destinations. Once again, the actual locations of these charcoal piles are still to be found, which is amazing, I think, usually by noticing stands of timber, mainly poplar, growing in a circular formation. By digging there, and I've done it, you can still find bushels of charcoal that was incompletely removed, and of course it's just as good as the day it was made over 100 years ago.
And you can find the tracks that the wagons made.
The old wagon roads, we call them wagon roads now, they're deeply rutted and washed by rain a great deal. But those old wagon roads mark the trails that the charcoal was hauled down off the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And of course they're still very visible today. My eldest sister was born on Mount Washington in 1888, the year of the blizzard.
Yes.
In a very comfortable cabin in which my father and mother survived that fabled fall of snow, which occurred on March 12th to 14th of that year. About 50 inches of snow fell in the area, in this area, in that historic
storm. Just imagine.
50 inches. When I asked my father how in the world they made it through that terrible time, he said they were never more comfortable. They had the foresight, as all people did in those days, to have a store of provisions laid by. There was no shortage of water or wood for heat, and I suspect a haunch of venison was not too far away. At any rate, the blizzard completely covered the cabin.
Mm-hmm.
So, as snug as a bug, they just simply waited for it to melt, which it did in a week to 10 days.
Yeah.
The snow was all gone, according to my father. A little interesting sidelight. When the men of the mountain felt in need of a little relaxation, my father always called them boys.
Yes.
They, upon the proper occasion, would repair down the mountain to the watering kettle in Salisbury. There they would meet with a select group of boys from the lower part of town and fight. From what my father told me, they fought the good fight. One worthy resident was so moved that he proceeded to bite the nose off his nearest opponent, which drew a great chorus of praise from his colleagues. An interesting story related to these phrases was that the gentleman who did the biting, whose name incidentally would still be remembered here in town, so he shall remain nameless, was a very powerful individual. So powerful indeed was he that he carried a 100-pound sack of grain from Selleck's mill to Hammertown, about 4 miles, where he lived, without setting it down once.
Uh-huh.
A prodigious feat of strength, which I do not doubt for a minute, because my dad told it to me.
Mm-hmm.
Boys would be boys, and as I say, my dad always called them boys.
Mm-hmm.
When the need for charcoal had somewhat subsided, my family descended from the mountain, and my oldest brother was born in Hammertown, so called because of the incessant hammering by a firm that produced scythe blades there, by the untiring hammering of wrought iron produced in the area. That hammering continued day and night, according to my dad. Next born was my youngest and still surviving brother, who was born 100 yards from where he now lives, in Chapinville, which was, of course, the name before Taconic received his name. At that time, my father worked at the ironworks at the outlet of Twin Lakes. There was produced a great quantity of pig iron ingots, which were loaded onto the spur of the CNE Railroad that was busy as a bee at that time. The waste product of that operation, in the form of a glass-like slag, produced the roadbed of miles of road in the Taconic area, as well as that of the railroad spur. And as a matter of fact, along that inlet today, the western bank of the inlet is solid slag. I know that because I cut my feet on it many, many times as I swam there as a kid. And the stuff is like glass and can be very, very sharp. But there's loads of it there still available. Well, anyway, when the pig iron business failed, my father was transferred to another location, and he moved to the small house that is now opposite the Dunn family house on the Under Mountain Road, the horse farm there, on Route 41. There he worked on the farm that was then owned by the Scoville family and was known as the sheep farm. And indeed it was a sheep farm because they had many, many hundreds of sheep at that time. From there he was transferred to the Scoville family farm, known then and still known as Grassland Farms. Since the distance was too great to walk, he rode a bicycle to work at first. And he rode one of the old high wheelers with a very tiny wheel in the rear.
Real energy conscious person there.
Well, not exactly. But he was so continually thrown head first off the beast that one day he threw it over the fence and bought one of the modern bikes with both wheels the same size. Mm-hmm. He said that restored his sanity. In this house were born a son who died at 8 after falling a fall from a tree. And my youngest sister was born there in 1904. She is also now dead. Then back to Taconic, still Chapinville, by my father, where I was born. No Sharon Hospital for me. I guess I was the last person alive. I believe I'm the last person alive who was born in Chapinville. This is not intended to be a family history, but I have to connect remembrances somehow.
Certainly.
I must tell you that I attended the grammar school in Chapinville. The school building built about 1900. And the reason why it was built, with the school originally, was up on the hill near the present Herbert Scoville's residence, and they needed that land immediately around the residence, so they donated the land to the town and in turn built the school in Chapinville.
The Do you remember your teachers there?
Oh, yes, indeed. Mm-hmm. Sure. My first, well, I hate to quote family all the time, but my mother died when I was 22 months old, so I never did really have a mother. So when I started to go to school at Taconic at age 5, my first teacher was Miss Fish, Edna Fish. Miss Fish's father worked at the power station, which was run by the Scoville family, which produced power for all the houses in the area that were connected to the Scoville farm, and even the power line was run from there over to Grassland Farm.
Goodness, yeah.
And the Grassland Farms was electrified from that point at the outlet of the lake. And as I say, my first teacher was Edna Fish, and I remember her still, and practically tears come to my eyes because, as I say, I had no mother.
And she took over that job for you, probably.
Well, she became my surrogate mother, I guess, and I can still remember her holding close to her, and when I wasn't feeling too well, and holding me against her bosom. And
is that a one-room schoolhouse, Paul?
No, it was a two-room schoolhouse.
With two doors?
And one main door. I'll tell you, tell you more about the school, how it was set up. Anyway, I attended the school there, starting when I was 5 years old. The school, incidentally, is now owned by Mrs. Melanie Barber, and is used as her residence.
That's right.
It was a beautiful building. It was built like they don't build them anymore. It was built upon a base of gray limestone, the same as the Scoville Library. The timbers that went into it were unbelievable. It was built to last forever.
Yes, she's very proud of it.
Oh, yes. And it was a two-room school, two large rooms, one at either side, and the two rooms were separated by a very, very tall folding door. Of course, everything seemed very, very tall to me at that time because I was very small. But I'd say that the ceilings in those rooms were about 15 to 18 feet tall. And the rooms were about, I would say, 35 feet square.
That's a good-sized room.
Those were good-sized rooms. And the upper grades were in one room and the lower grades in the other. And it was easily the best school that's ever been built in the town of Salisbury. Oh, without a doubt. I do not kid you. Even to this present day. I mean, the most solidly constructed.
Sure.
At the rear was a field that generations of kids used as a beautiful playground, and a ball field that sloped quite a bit to the east. Well, we played a lot of good ball on it. It was there that my greatest aspiration was to hit a baseball as far as Gurdon Pickard and Art Baldwin did. Gurdon Pickard and Art Baldwin are still around and pretty well known in the area if they're some years older than I. They occasionally hit the southern exposure of the school and broke a window. I never did. Over the front entrance was a hand-carved plaque which bore the first profound statement I ever read. And I was very much impressed. It read, and I hope it still does, "Hear instruction and be wise." Here, most of the kids and I went to school barefooted. During the warm summer months, at least. That may not seem unusual, but I merely pointed out to show the difference between those days and these.
Right.
Here, too, I observed what discipline was all about. When one of the older boys was rapped severely on the knuckles with a sturdy wooden ruler because he insisted on saying ain't in the dictionary. Miss Scott, the upper grade teacher, who was tall, red-headed, raw-boned, and fully capable of handling any boy in the room, and there were some big ones, but she sure could handle them. The boy's name, incidentally, will remain unknown because his family still lives in the area. Yes.
He hasn't forgotten it.
No, he's still alive. He does not live in the area anymore, but his name is well known. But his name was John Mattis. There are many colorful characters about the village of Chapinville at that time. Old Fred Gordon ran the general store with a real Cracker Barrel. He chewed tobacco constantly and delighted in spitting the juice on our bare feet.
I bet.
Our house was visited twice a year by an itinerant peddler, once in the spring and once in the fall. He carried an assortment of pots and pans, dress goods and knickknacks, also patent medicines and herbs. I'll never forget Atwood's bitters and swamp root and castor oil. And various times I was induced to sample all of these. I was very much afraid of him. I thought he was out of the Bible. Maybe he was. Also, some of my father's old friends had succumbed to the automobile, and they drove up to our home behind the former site of Camp Everett in some remarkable vehicles. The first I remember were open, noisy, smoky, and were steered by a tiller.
Oh, goodness.
One was a very early Renault. It was enormous. I was afraid of that, too. Thus, I have witnessed our progression from the house, horse and buggy, to the Concord. But I sometimes wonder if our progress has made us any happier. Perhaps the most interesting of the old-timers, I'd like to tell you about these because they're part of my past and part of the memories that I will always have. But about the most interesting were the brothers Funk, called the Funk Boys.
How do you spell their last
Funk,
name?
F-U-N-K.
Really? All right.
Dave and Phil Funk.
Uh-huh.
Who lived in a little shingled house near Hammertown Pond. The house is still there. It's been added to in recent years. But the house in the tucked away in a little depression is still there. And case you misunderstand the name of the younger brother, his real name was not P-H-I-L, but F-I-L-L. His name was Fillmore.
Yes.
Therefore, Phil. Phil ordered Dave around without mercy, and Dave was the elder. He was short, stocky, with beautiful white hair, and he cheerfully did all the cooking, washing up, and all the other household chores. They had worked the charcoal at the very last of it, and were woodsmen of the highest order. Dave could chop a tree down and then chop it up, and the chop marks left by his axe were as smooth as if they had been planed.
Mm.
I never saw anything like it. During their late years, they made their living hunting and trapping, and were extremely skilled in their chosen work. They never lacked for money. Phil carried the pocketbook. Of course, they walked wherever they went, and invariably, as they went, Phil walked in front, and Dave, with his hands behind his back, walked along behind. Dave always agreed with whatever Phil said. Phil would spin a yarn, and then he'd turn to his brother and say, "Ain't that right, Dave?"
"Yep."
Dave answered, "That's right, Dave. That's right, Phil." One of Phil's favorite stories concerned one night they were hunting coons up on the mountain. The dog began to whimper, and looking up at a moonlight tree where they thought the coon was treed, they saw an enormous wildcat. Just as the cat sprung at them, Phil let him have both barrels, and the cat hit the ground. "And the next time I saw him, he was out of sight," says Phil. "Ain't that right, Dave?" "That's right, Phil," responds Dave. They came to our house a great deal where they played euchre.
What's that?
Euchre is an old-time game which is still played. It's one heck of a lot of fun. It involves a deck of cards where the small card is taken out, and they use the joker, and the jack of the suit, the trump that is played, is the right bower, and the corresponding colored jack, like spades or clubs, is called the left bower.
Uh-huh.
It goes on from there. But anyway, they played with my father and another crony. Dave was always my father's partner. They hit the table so hard with their knuckles when they played a deciding card that the dishes rattled across the room. Late in the evening, when an appropriate amount of cider had been consumed, off they'd go for home, Dave carefully following Phil so he wouldn't go wrong. In their last years, Phil bought a Model T Ford, four-door sedan. Phil drove, and Dave drove in the rear seat. Phil never called it a Ford. He called it my big glass car. For many years, Dave and Phil acted as wardens guarding Fisher's Pond.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Fisher, everyone knows Jack. He was Jack's father. And stocked it heavily with trout and perch and pickerel, although the trout did not survive. The pickerel did. Some grew to enormous size. On the east side of the pond, where Mr. Schweikert built his large home, there was an area where a gently sloping rock slid down into the water. My childhood buddy, Stubb McLean, and I would sneak over there with the long bamboo poles. We'd catch a small perch and insert a large hook through its head. We'd throw it far out and skitter it to shore. Before many casts, a huge pickerel would become enraged and seize the perch. They would not let go. Finally, we'd haul them up on the sloping stone of the water, and we'd have them without ever having touched them with a hook.
Oh, the pickerel.
These huge pickerel,
mm-hmm.
They're 30 inches and over. I've told the story to many people. No one believes me.
No, really? You should have had a picture.
But it's true.
Yes. I believe you.
Yep. Well, after completing 8 years of schooling at Taconic School, I went with all the rest of the kids to Lakeville High School, which at that time was located where the post office now stands.
Mm-hmm.
You recall that?
I do.
Do you?
Right. Miss Esther Frank was there, the nurse? Maybe not when you were there.
Not really. The upper grades of the grammar school were on the first floor, supervised with an iron hand and a velvet heart by Miss Mahar,
mm-hmm.
now Mrs. Eggleston.
Mm-hmm.
Never was a school run by a firmer hand.
I believe it.
Upstairs was high school, consisting of one large assembly room and two classrooms. At the rear was a rather constricted playground, baseball field. Left field ran into a very high embankment. A Tony Mountain goes to play that left field.
Mm-hmm.
While the game was in progress, which was any time weather permitted, the non-playing boys and girls played the best they could in amongst the ball players, which wasn't exactly safe, but we had a lot of fun anyway. Transporting us to school usually was J.C. Pickard. At least he carried us to Ticknor Corner, where the Taconic Road meets Route 44. I very well remember his 22 Chandler touring car.
It wasn't a school bus, it was his own car?
Yeah, it was his own personal car.
Yes.
And he always gave us a great thrill going over the railroad bridge at Taconic Station. The road went abruptly up and over the track, and when hit at a certain speed, the occupants of the rear seat flew into the air and came down approximately anywhere, but hopefully still in the car. Often in the spring, the Taconic Road was a sea of mud, deep mud. Then Gurdon Pickard, J.C.'s son, drove a gray Model T touring car. Gurdon would locate the wheels safely in a rut, and then that Ford would track that rut, either in low or high gear, and chug along with the mud really up to the hubs. And I don't ever remember getting stuck.
You always got to school.
We always got to school. Gurdon was going to Hotchkiss School at the time, where he started football and basketball, or baseball, I should say. Two winters, when the roads were nearly impassable, we rode the CNE railroad station, a railroad from Taconic to Lakeville, which was great fun. One special morning will remain forever in my mind. While the other kids were getting on the train, the milk was being taken out of the Borden milk station there. I ran to the head of the train. I was just a little kid at the time. I ran up to the engine and I said, please, mister, can I ride in the locomotive? To my complete surprise, the engineers looked around, scared like, and said, well, okay, come on. So he reached down and lifted me up into the cab, and I rode in that locomotive from Taconic to Salisbury.
Wasn't that a thrill?
Well, it was more of a thrill than you can imagine, because going down that roadbed at high speed, which I would say 40 to 45 miles an hour perhaps, the locomotive swung from side to side, and I was absolutely petrified. But at any rate, we got to Salisbury in one piece, and then the engineer, because I'm sure he was afraid he'd get in trouble for letting a kid ride in a cab, says, okay, son, that's as far as you go. So I got out of the cab and ran to the rear of the train and jumped on the car with the rest of the kids and proceeded from there to Lakeville. Well, I'll never forget that ride, and I don't think there are too many kids in the area that ever did actually ride in the cab of a locomotive, especially a steam locomotive. Speaking of those locomotives, I know that millions of people will agree with me when I say we really lost something when we lost the old steam locomotive.
Not to hear them at night anymore.
To hear them at night, I would lie in bed up at Taconic, which was higher than the railroad station, the track that ran through Taconic and over the lake to Twin Lakes. And I'd hear those whistles from a great distance. And they were so mournful, and yet I'm just sorry that sound has disappeared.
Yes,
American
I am
scene.
Too.
As a matter of fact, records have been made of the old locomotive sounds, and they recall a great day. Of course, the CNE at that time was, as I said before, as busy as a bee. I remember when I was a small kid, and we had four passenger trains each way per day.
Oh, four? Yes.
Four passenger trains each way running from the Poughkeepsie line to Hartford.
Oh, but that train that you came down from Taconic towards Salisbury would be going all the way into Millerton, wouldn't it?
Yes. Oh, yes. That proceeded on to Millerton. The old...
Go right across. It went right through Lakeville.
It sure did.
Yes. Right near where our filling station is, crossing by Farnham Road. All the way up there.
Across there on a high trestle, which wasn't removed too many years ago.
No, that's true.
So, those were the great old days, I guess.